Thank you for joining us for this episode of Journey Now, produced by Journey Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. For more information on Journey Church and our gatherings, visit journeytn.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Journey Now podcast. My name is Mike Urie, and I am joined today by Susie Lind and a very special guest, Mr. Daniel Jones.
Yay!
Hello.
Daniel, tell us just a little bit about yourself. You've been a longtime Journey community person, but just tell us like what you're up to. Tell us just a little about who you are.
Well, I was born.
Yes.
That's funny.
Laugh was amazing.
It was.
It's like, how far back do we want to go?
Yeah.
Set the scene in 1992, Camden, New Jersey.
I didn't want to hear that. That's disgusting.
I know.
I was in college. Stop laughing. Okay. All right. 1992. Joy.
92. The Blue Jays were about to win the World Series.
Yeah. You remember that fondly?
I do. Very fondly. Like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
No, I'm Daniel. I live here. My wife, Gabby, and I live in Spring Hill. Nice. We've lived in the Nashville area, me for 5 years. She's lived here for four. She works direct sales, so she gets to work from home at network marketing, which is she's really great at. And then I do a bunch of stuff. Play music, run social media, run sessions, play in sessions.
Nice.
Just feel like in order to live as a human being these days in the workforce, you have to do tens of millions of things.
Yeah.
So just trying to slowly add things to my tool belt.
Especially when you're a creative genius.
I don't know about creative genius, but I am creative, yes.
He's wearing a shirt that says spiritual.
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to be repping that, there's something, it's saying something about you. I would never have that on my shirt because I don't want to live up to that.
Honestly, same, but I just like the shirt and like the brand.
Anyway, today I wanna have a conversation, and we were just joking before we got on air. I don't ever tell anybody what we're gonna talk about. That's part of
my angst.
Yes, so totally. That's why Susie is always asking clarifying questions.
Yes.
But you know, we wanna have conversations about real stuff going on, and hopefully do it in a way that's both lighthearted but substantive and generous and kind with each other. And so I wanted to talk about this phenomenon that I think some of us, we are familiar with, but I think some people, I get questions on it every now and again that really aren't familiar with the idea, but it's the idea of deconstruction. People are using that to describe a process through kind of their faith where they're asking sort of big questions. They're looking at their inherited belief system and saying, I'm not sure I buy that anymore. And some people think this is a very negative thing that leads to no faith at all. Some people think it's an okay thing, a necessary thing. Some people think it's a good thing. But I wanted just to talk a little bit about first, the first question is, if you were pressed on describing this process, how would you? So what is, and again, we're not looking for formal definitions, but just because we've used this language and people have used this language around us. And so what is it for you? What does deconstructing mean for you?
The first thing that came to my mind was Legos.
Yes.
Because it's good imagery. Like, you know, my kids get a Lego set and it comes with like this insane direction thing that somehow they're able to figure out. I've never been able to figure it out, but they're really good at it. And they construct this like awesome, like, you know, Star Wars ship of some sort.
Intricate.
Yeah. And it's super detailed down to like the tiny little flat square pieces.
Yes.
And they know exactly where they're supposed to go and everything. And then, you know, it gets put up on a shelf or something and it might get knocked down and it falls apart and then it's hard to put back together. And so they figure out a new way to put it back together. But then I think about deconstruction being you pull apart each of the pieces to that and you might create something new. And, you know, sometimes it just gets all left in the Lego box in a bazillion different pieces. And sometimes it becomes something new, but it's still Legos. So, you know, I've had the privilege of getting to walk with people alongside people who would say that that's what they're doing. And I've done it as well, where you pulled apart the things that you've inherited mm-hmm. in your faith, the things that you've learned, and really taken a look at their purpose, your understanding of them, and whether you actually still believe what was taught to you about that mm-hmm. and how it works with how you've now experienced God and what you have learned about God. And I think that becomes the struggle for a lot of people, is what they've learned about God doesn't match how they've come to know God.
Hmm. Is that true for you, Daniel? Does that resonate?
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it.
Is that something you've experienced or walked through a little bit?
Definitely. I feel like we're always in a constant state of taking apart the Legos and putting them back together. I just think it's super healthy to do that. We're probably jumping the gun, but I feel like...
Dude, that's what we're here. That's why we're here.
I can see why people...
Guns are to be jumped.
Guns are to be jumped. That's our next album. That's our next sermon series. I can see why people... Because that's that statement, those what you were saying, Suze, that is very terrifying. Mm-hmm. Because we're a people. I would say a culture, but human race is this way. Like, we want control. Mm-hmm. It's like our parents and grandparents traditionally raised us in a certain Christian tradition. So we would all like believe the same and do the same. I don't think out of like this malicious control thing, but that's what it kind of turned into, mm-hmm. you know? So then you have people who are like your age and
our age and left our age there. You know, come on, Daniel. Daniel, for the record, is in his 20s. I'm in my mid-30s. Susie's in her 40s. So
oh, it's wow.
It's a rough
wow. Thing.
Just in case people were curious.
Randy's just listening to another sermon.
And that's our producer, Randy, who is totally checked out of our conversation and is now just checking out Instagram.
And now this is when I check to make sure my phone's on silent.
That was amazing.
I love it.
Randy, keep it in. Oh yeah. Yes. All right. So then a question becomes, how do we keep that the impulse, or in your guys' word, the need to sort of deconstruct? How do we hold that in tension with the fact that Christianity is an inherited faith? This isn't something we just get to make up as we go. How do we hold those two in tension and or in balance?
Who knows?
Right.
That's an everyday thing. I think secondly, we have to acknowledge, maybe not secondly. I'm going to say this and hopefully it ties into what you just asked, Mike.
Let me tell you, if it doesn't, another gun has been jumped and we're just fine.
Fantastic. We have to first acknowledge that deconstruction is not bad and is not evil or the devil, A. And I believe, B, we also have to be reminded that in that process, we don't get to rebuild God in our own image.
Okay. Mm.
The people I know who preach against deconstruction are worried about the latter, mm-hmm. thus throwing out the former. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that I know personally who have built faith in the new way and are a lot happier and all this stuff, and that's awesome, but they've built God in their own image, mm-hmm. and that's not, personally, mm-hmm. I don't think that is what Jesus has asked us to do.
Okay.
And how we live our life.
All right, that's good. Susie, how can deconstruction be a good thing if it can lead to the Legos in the box, just abandoning faith altogether, or, as Daniel's saying, just kind of creating a God in our own image? Why should we encourage it at all then?
Well, so for me, my personality, it's the easy answer is because it's important to know your why, like, because I'm a person who always needs to know why. And I think knowing what you believe is important, but knowing why you believe and how you got there is also important. And so you know, we're all, it's interesting because I had a conversation about this via Messenger this morning with an old friend. And, you know, we're given a certain set of beliefs through whatever environment we've been given them to. And like the messaging relies on the recipient of the messenger of the message to process through their mm-hmm. lens, right? Mm-hmm. And so we all come with this view from a point. We all come with our bias. We all come with all those things. And so that's not a bad thing. That's kind of an image of God thing, I mm-hmm. think. And so if you can look at it that way, and you can look at the that God doesn't expect us to not question and to not ask why and to mm-hmm. and to not explore and try to understand however it is that he's made us to do that, then there's a little bit of freedom in taking those steps. And then that deconstruction process could actually lead you to believe in deeper and more meaningful ways if you are willing to do the work of looking at it not just from your own lens but from the lens of others and read other points of view and hold space for multiple perspectives until you get to the place that mm-hmm. God is hopefully leading you. I think the key is not doing it alone, right? No. You know?
There it is.
You know, I remember the first time I ever heard a message from someone, a guy named James Pettifills, he's actually younger than me, but he was the youth pastor at the time. And I heard
there's a lot of people younger than you, Susie. I'm just going to throw that out.
Why? You're making a point of that.
Nice.
Just because Daniel's here.
Just because he distinguished himself from us.
Mm-hmm. I'm just resisting. Just looking at the age brackets.
Yeah,
that's
but,
all.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. And it doesn't really matter that James was younger than me. It was just like very profound to me at the time. And it was the first time I'd ever heard somebody preach about doubting. You know, and he said it was very simple, but he said to prayerfully engage your doubts.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So it's like sometimes I think we go through a season of deconstruction or whatever, and we try to do it without God because we don't think God belongs in that somehow.
Wow.
And okay. I think if we can prayerfully engage if we can talk to God, like the guy in Mark 9 who said, "I believe, but help my unbelief," you know, like if we can engage with God in that and engage with our community, and again, I guess you have to feel safe in your community to do that, but which is another whole, we could do a whole nother podcast on that. But that to me is the key, because left to our own devices, I don't think anything is really super healthy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And you know, I've heard from loads of people, the same concerns. But when you read the Gospels, I mean, we're doing a little thing through the book of Mark. Jesus is the agent of deconstruction.
Right.
Yeah.
He is constantly, "Hey, Jesus, look at this temple. Yeah. Well, let me tell you. Hey, Jesus, you're the Messiah." Yeah, but
yeah, I mean, you've heard it said.
Yes, but I tell you.
Yeah.
And so he is the agent mm-hmm. of deconstructing.
That's good.
So I think there's a form of deconstruction that is rebellious, or that is stiff-necked in biblical terms. That's just in the same way we can use intellectual conversations to hold things at a distance. Mm-hmm. Deconstruction can just be an exercise in doing whatever I want.
Right.
Yeah.
Because hey, there are all these other people who think this is crap. So I'm entitled to think it's crap too.
Yeah, which you are.
but there is another word for deconstruction in the biblical tradition, and that's discipleship.
Come on, dude.
It is the constant renovation of our thinking about God. And the saddest thing for Christians, and you see this when Jesus comes across the fossilized believings of some of the Jews of his day, the saddest thing is that you just cease being curious because you think you know and understand, and you're good, you've got it, you figured it out. And Jesus will actively oppose people who sit in that posture towards him.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when, you know, we're looking kind of at the church in America and seeing, oh my goodness, all of this stuff surface. I think Jesus is the author of that. I think when he says everything said and done in the dark will be shouted, I mean, we're getting a glimpse of what that's like. So I cheer all of this on. But for many, it's totally destructive. And so we would distinguish between deconstructing your faith and deconstructing the subculture where your faith was handed to you.
Ooh, that's really good. That's say more really about good. That.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, the faith, I mean, when Paul says, I received what I gave to you, that Jesus died according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he rose again according to the third day, on the third day according to the scriptures, and then he began appearing to his disciples, right? That kernel, that nugget, mm-hmm. right, that he says is the gospel. We don't get to argue with that. I mean, we can, but at some point we're not Christian in the proper sense anymore. But along with that announcement came all of this subculture, whether it's understandings of purity and modesty and sexuality, understandings of gender roles and stereotypes, understandings of ecclesiology and how pastors are different from regular church members, whether it's the manipulation and pressure to give money to the organization. I mean, it plays itself out. For those of us who are our age, Daniel, of whom you are not.
Well played.
We grew up in the middle of a Christian marketing explosion where there were Christian substitutes for everything. But that we were told that the way we should relate to the world is by just creating our own subculture. And many of us are finding out that the people who created the subculture and led the subculture and who were paradigm examples of the subculture.
The correct term is set apartness.
Yes, we are holy. That's what holy means.
Lord have mercy.
Totally. So, but we're seeing all of this go down in flames.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't touch the faith. For some people, it does.
Yes.
Yeah, for some people, it was taught, and this was one of the problems of the subculture.
Yes.
It was taught that the faith was the subculture.
Come on, dude.
And so if you go after the subculture, you're going after the faith. And there are a bunch of us who are saying, that's not true.
Yeah.
That's not true. Mm-hmm. And how do we know? We go back to the text. Deconstruction was a literary term originally. And it was how... It was the ruthless examination of assumptions that we bring to a text, allowing the text to deconstruct us, not us deconstructing the text. And so that it was actually a great, great thing. So that's how we're to approach the scriptures, right? It's not, hey, I've read this. What's this verse mean to me? It's, okay, God, you're pulling me into something I don't understand, and it's terrifying, and it's fearful, and it's marvelous, and it's wonderful, and I'm okay that I don't understand it.
Wow.
And the little box I was given to understand this when I was 10, that was well-intentioned, but it isn't the biblical box. The biblical box is wild and crazy. So I just want to affirm what you are both saying by saying this is a very biblical thing. Mm-hmm. It can be used, of course, as an excuse like everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But part of the reason why we want to do this podcast is to facilitate deconstruction.
Yeah.
Because part of my inherited faith was Christians vote Republican. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Christians protect the Second Amendment.
Yes.
Christians are for highly enforced borders.
Yeah.
Christians are pro-death penalty and anti-abortion. Mm-hmm. And there was just this list that wasn't in the... Jesus died, Jesus rose again, Jesus, you know, that, but it was given the same weight as that list.
Right.
And that's where we're like, hey, that's not true. And I think it's a good thing and we want to bless it. Correct?
Yeah.
Correct.
So for you, Daniel, what's been an area that you've seen the church sort of be exposed on that has been very hopeful for you that you're kind of cheering on?
A handful of things.
Yeah.
On the topic of racism, that being exposed publicly over the last year has been really good.
Boy.
I mean, in that exposure, people have done it well and also haven't.
Right. Totally.
Because it's easy in that conversation to slip into, well, this is how we've always done things, or... and calling other people who are trying to awaken like Marxists, mm-hmm. which I can see how he can slip into Marxism. That makes total sense to me. But besides all of that, just mm-hmm. In a predominantly white culture,
right?
In a predominantly even white subculture of Christianity, because Christianity is not just for the white man, which is what a lot of black people believe, which I get.
Right.
It's not true. Historically, it's not even true.
No.
But in this context, in America, mm-hmm. it is, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. it is that. And it's, I've been really impressed with people just asking questions and sitting down at tables together going, how do we do this mm-hmm. better? That's pretty special. Mm-hmm. That was not the case even when I was a kid in the early 90s. Mm. And again, in the Christian American context.
Yeah.
What I knew growing up. Mm-hmm. Like, I had my black church with my family, and then I went to Presbyterian church for youth group. Mm-hmm. And they were very separate, not mm-hmm. because one hated the other, mm-hmm. but it was, this is just what we do.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So I'm really thankful that people are just through set awful events have been able to like come out of that like
totally
thing. But a lot of resistance to that has been somewhat because of the culture of mm-hmm. if you're a Christian, you vote Republican. Mm-hmm. And this thing can be an opposition to
totally.
Conservative Republican.
This feels liberal.
It's a liberal agenda, which, gosh, what a crazy drinking game that would be. Every time you heard liberal agenda or the right. If I heard like the right is doing this or the liberal agenda is this, it's like I would be drunk 24/7 because it's just insane how often.
I mean, some people think we're drunk, to be fair.
But it's only 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
It's an axe joke. Axe joke.
Right, yeah, there. This is true. Peter, when he stands up after the...
Come on, DJ!
After Pentecost.
Nailed it, man.
My mom is a biblical whiz.
Yes.
So thank you, Charmaine.
Funny. Yes, that's so good.
But, so I'm encouraging that.
Yeah.
I'm encouraging that because...
And you know what that's called? Discipleship. Oh, gee, mm-hmm. there's some stuff we haven't dealt with that we need to learn about.
Yeah.
Let's do that as apprentices of Jesus, right?
100%. And it's sad that in doing that... I'm harping on it because it's the thing that I know that I can see in front of me.
Yes.
And in doing that, because it goes up against the kingdom of values that are not actually a part of the gospel. It's not Jesus died, Jesus rose again.
Right.
Now go and do the same.
Right.
It goes against how we were taught.
Right.
How a group of people have been taught.
Yeah.
It's communicated that, oh, this isn't the gospel at all, and we need to get back to the gospel.
Well, that's because people skip a step from Jesus died, Jesus rose again, or Jesus came, and then Jesus lived. We kind of forget that part, and then we jump to Jesus died and rose again.
Yes. Yes.
And so if we want to talk about how he lived and what he lived for, then it actually does become the gospel.
100%.
Susie, what do you see that kind of being exposed that gives you hope? Daniel, thank you, by the way.
No, that's
I have more questions for Daniel, but okay.
We can do it all. I'll try my best.
Yeah, go there if you want to.
I think what I'm seeing exposed actually is through all of my beloved friends who have been deconstructing. What I'm seeing being exposed is, I think it was it in... it was in Velvet Elvis, right? Where Rob Bell talks
Hold
about
on.
The... I know, I'm sorry.
What?
I know that's a trigger for some people, but this is a good... this was always a good analogy, and it really was helpful when he talked about the brick wall. Mm-hmm. And if you take a brick out, then the whole thing crumbles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is a very great analogy of what we see, because... people who have been the ones who have been the purveyors of these messages are now being pushed into the why. And so, you know, things are coming to light and people are changing their minds about important things and their minds are lining up, I think, with more of the mind of Christ when it comes to things like including women, talking about racism, elevating children, practicing things like caring for orphans and widows and stuff like that. So I think it's coming out. But my question for Daniel, can I ask a question? Do we have time?
Yeah.
Because in it,
where are we, Randy? 25. We got time.
Okay. Because in addition to, in addition to the racism thing, you're also part of our worship team, and we've had a lot of conversations about worship. So.
Oh yeah.
I mean, how have you seen that?
She's fishing.
How have I seen that? What change? Or how,
yeah, was that the original question? What have you seen?
What have you seen deconstructed that gives you hope?
What have you seen deconstructed that gives you hope in the worship space? Well, I'll just leave it at that, and you can define what that is.
So there's a podcast now that's out with Jeremy Riddle and Matt Redman, and they are doing that. And these are giants in worship culture. Matt Redman's been is an actual legend. And Jeremy Riddle's not that far behind. And it's the same, just in his own way, because more prophetic vineyard. He comes from the Vineyard Church in Cali, and Matt Redman's from the UK, and is just very liturgical, but has written, I call many hymns for the modern-day worship movement. And so they get together, and they start basically doing what we're doing now, but they've been doing it with just each other, like, because their families are really tight. They both live in Cali, and like, we've been talking about this for years, and now they have like 20 plus years of like the worship industry under their belts, which neither of them asked for. So they're going, every podcast is labeled like something versus something else. So marketing versus mantle, or confirmation versus, I need to look them up, but it's contrasting of, okay, what is God called us to actually worship, and then what have we done with it, and how do we like work through the middle in between of that? It's been very convicting, because it's literally anti everything that is currently going on. And they even said in the beginning, they're like, we're not out here to like bash anybody.
Right.
This is not, we're taking names.
Right.
It's not even a, you agree with us so we can start a movement. He goes, we're over that.
Right.
This is just what we've seen over the last 25 years and what our hearts have broken for, and what Yahweh's been teaching us about what it means to worship him in spirit and in truth.
Come on.
And it's very, very counter everything.
Yeah.
Even down to like, should what people in worship like repost when people like tag him and stuff.
Right.
Like, what is that for? Is that for the Lord? Or is that for you?
Right.
Like they get to that level.
Yeah.
So it's things like that that make me very encouraged, because people have been talking about that on the low for a long time, especially people of millennials and Gen Zers.
Like us.
Yeah. Like us. People like us have been talking about this for a long time, especially you guys being from the church context you've been in out.
Oh, that
West.
Is the thing.
Yeah, it's like it's the biggest thing, and the South has it too.
Yeah,
but they come at it from a different way. So we all have been talking about this for decades, and so I'm encouraged that people who are of more sober minds that have been in this for a long time, especially in the industry of it, because now worship can be an industry,
totally.
Right?
Yeah,
which that's a whole nother rabbit trail. So I'm encouraged that. Even this from these two giants and people on the low, just having conversations like these are like, just because it has, just because we've done it this way does not mean it has to be that way. Like, what is the Lord doing for our environment? What's the Lord doing for our congregation? Preach. What does our team need?
That's right.
Do we have to have full band? Do we always have to do acoustic sets? Like, do we need to do blah, blah, blah? Do we even have to have music this week? Like, people are asking those having those conversations and asking those questions.
Well, it sounds like it also helps expand the conversation to help people understand that worship is more than a song.
Oh, Redman put it best.
It's true. He actually goes into the story of why he wrote that song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because their pastor got super convicted and was like, we're running a machine.
Yeah.
So no
like,
one.
I'll give you more than a song.
And he literally goes, we're not doing music.
I remember that was for like 6 months.
Right? Yeah, it was 6 months. And then Matt's like, do I even have a job? Like, what's going on?
Right.
But that's when he wrote Heart of Worship, because he's like, this is nothing, and yet we're still encountering the living God, which is holy cow. So
come on.
That's
great.
It's good.
Yeah. And that's different for each person. So I think it's easy.
Totally.
Like how we are pursuing it here at Journey is how we're pursuing it at Journey. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that's how our guys at Belonging do it. Doesn't mean that's how our friends at the Bridge should do it. I think we love to make our camps and then go, it has to be like this. Mm-hmm. This is the template. And it's like, well, is it meeting these like biblical requirements to set space for people to encounter the Lord privately and publicly? Great. Then however you get there is fine.
Well, that move to think that we're doing it right is, you know, that's part of the problem.
Hmm.
Like that's immediately we've left worship and we've now gone to something else.
Wow.
You know, so.
Well, I think it's interesting that we started this conversation about deconstruction and we brought it, you know.
You brought it.
Around to worship. I think there's something there.
Yes.
In what way?
I don't know.
Well, worship is like, justice in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Worship has nothing to do with your performative religious acts. It's always tied to justice. Wow. So, worship is social justice. I mean,
I knew it was something.
It just I mean, how many passages, Daniel? You know this. How many passages does God refuse the performative rituals of Israel because of the injustice at the heart of the community?
Jeez.
So worship, I mean, and that's, so we've made the industry around a bit that doesn't even qualify in biblical terms, unless you want to go Psalms and say, okay, cool, Psalms.
Yeah.
But, you know, you would never have monetized Psalms back in the day. So here's capitalism, and like, we're just little capitalists at heart. And and so, yes, there is a legit deconstruction that says, if we think that the race conversation is different than the worship conversation, then we're not reading our entire Bibles. The entire Bible shouts at you, this is the same conversation.
Wow.
Love God, love neighbor is the same thing. End of story.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll end on that note.
Matt Redman called. He wants you to be a guest on the podcast.
Nice. I'll bring him more than a song. So anyway, if you don't know, that's a reference to a song he wrote that was very famous in the 90s when Daniel was born. So
came out the same day I emerged.
Yes, as the Blue Jays were
winning
their World Series pursuit. All right, well, friends, and shout out to Randy, who has interrupted more on this podcast than all of them put together. And someday we're going to get him on mic. It's going to be glorious.
We have to. We'll switch roles.
It's
going
to be glorious. But anyway, thank you so much for tuning in. We're going to hand it over to Susie, and who is kind of our expert interviewer and question asker. And it's been so fun to kind of get to know different parts of our community, not just our church community, but the broader sort of community in this area through that. And as always, if this is helpful, share it, like it, rate it, subscribe it. That's the, you know, that keeps the algorithms happy. Until next time, friends, thanks for tuning in.
Hey everyone, thank you for continuing to listen to the Journey Now podcast. My name is Susie Lind and I am your host for this second half. We love receiving your feedback as it does help us shape our content. So don't be afraid to let us know what you think by leaving us a review or emailing us at journey@journeytn.com. My interview today is with the fabulous Dr. Ebony Webb. I met her a couple months ago, and man, to be with her is to be in the presence of something really divine. Dr. Webb is the founder of the Village of Kairos, which offers expanded therapy programs and restorative services in Franklin and Nashville. You can also experience her and her team live every Friday on Facebook on the Village of Kairos Facebook page.
In addition to her work with the Village of Kairos, Dr. Webb founded Webb Jam Consulting in 2019, through which she offers premier trauma-focused trainings, workshops, and consultations for agencies, clinicians, and families in crisis. In our conversation today, Dr. Webb shares with us what she's seeing through her work and her life as a Christian post-2020. We touch on issues like anxiety, trauma, and identity. I think you'll find what she has to offer really interesting. And if you ever need local therapy or help working through some of life's big issues, Dr. Webb is a great resource. I hope you enjoy our conversation today and are inspired by Dr. Webb. Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, your family, and a little bit of your inherited faith?
Oh, yes. So, where do I even begin? Well, I always say, if you can't already tell, I did not grow up in the South. I am a Midwesterner, so some of my terminologies will sound very farm country land. But my parents actually were born and raised in Gary, Indiana, and they decided to make a move in the 70s and moved into central Illinois, which is Lincoln, Illinois, 3 hours south of Chicago. So most people think, oh, you're from Chicago if you're from Illinois. No, just think of Chicago as like our 52nd or 51st, 52nd state. Okay. Because it's a totally different experience, but where I grew up was not very diverse at all. But my parents moved there because my dad decided, he was called into the ministry and he did not want to be a pastor of a church. He wanted to be a prison chaplain.
Wow.
And so Illinois is a very large prison state. And he was a prison chaplain in Logan County Correctional Center. And that really, I'm going to have to say, really informed so much of my faith as a child. I know my dad loved that position. He had all the diversity, for better or for worse, that he could experience. But, you know, I think what was so transformative about that was from a very early age, I was exposed to people who, I'm not even going to lie, when you're at the bottom, when I mean, prison is the absolute reality of I have failed in some capacity, either of my own making or not. And there is no getting out of this. When you go into a worship service in a prison, there's nothing like it, right? There is nothing like it. And although I grew up in a home where on Sundays, my mom and I went to a local Christian church and my dad was at work, there were many times where we would go into the prison to participate in worship. Many men, there are men there to this day.
Wow.
Who know me because they've been in prison that long. They watched me grow up. And I think it did them well. That correctional facility went through a time when it was all men and then it was co-ed, which was disastrous. I won't tell you the number of pregnancies that happened during that time. But then it went to all female. And so it was so interesting as a child going in, my dad would bring me in during like Father's Day or Mother's Day and just the connection that the inmates would have with me. And I was never fearful of any of that, you know.
That's amazing.
It was just, you know, going to see dad at work, you know, bring a daughter to work day. It just happened to be a prison. And as men and women would be, you know, paroled, my dad would invite them, you know, if he developed a relationship with them to our home, he would, you know, make sure that they, you know, were transitioning out well. And he would, frequent the businesses that they were working at. And so, you know, that was a really informative part of my faith. His father was a pastor for Church of Christ. And so, I mean, I've grown up with like kind of generations of pastors. And so, you know, I just really had a deep heart for the forgotten, you know?
Yeah.
And Illinois will throw the key away on you pretty quickly. I mean, truly, there are people in prison for writing bad checks. I mean, it's just, it's a very, very tough space to be in. And in fact, I thought that I felt very called initially to be a psychologist in the criminal justice system, but working and interning for a very long time, you know, through the summers and watching, especially men of color who were like 18 years old in prison for 40, 50 years, and watching their families come in, I knew this is not where I wanted to be. I wanted to be more in a preventative role before we get to this point.
Yeah.
Because it is my belief, my father and I've talked about this, is that the only change that I see, lasting change in prisons, are those who have some faith conversion, period. It just is. I mean, the psychologists there are great, but they're burnt out because their work is constantly repeated. But it's the clergy and any prison system that gets rid of those rights for inmates. You don't want to see those people on the streets. And so I really believe that prison should be left to the domain of the divine and clergy. So, you know, in my childhood, though, my mother was also a LD teacher. So she taught learning disabled teenagers. She was for junior and seniors in high school. And so I grew up with parents who were deep advocates for those who struggle.
Yeah.
And my mother was a poet. And so she would bring poets into the house. I mean, so it was this really interesting mix of experiences. I'm always a sucker for a good story, I think, thanks to my mother, but also the amazing stories of the people who were changed in their relationship with my dad. I loved, and I've carried this even in my work. My dad never wanted to know what an inmate was in for. He let them tell their story and let that unfold. And I try to avoid that as much. I don't typically request records until I've had a good number of sessions with clients, because I want them to allow their story to unfold. You know, because there can be so much shame in our stories. And so, you know, now I will say, for the record, I did not start out thinking I was going to be a psychologist. Probably in middle school, I thought that I was going to be a chef. And I actually I did a stage with a chef and thought I was going into culinary arts. And I spent a summer in a kitchen working 18 hours, loving it, but being completely burnt out by it. And
it's hard work.
Yeah. And I was a junior in high school and I was doing that. And the conversations I had with the chefs in that kitchen were just, you have to be completely, that's your life.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of addiction. You know, there are a lot of things as a teenager, I'm like, yeah, I probably shouldn't tell my mom and dad that I'm being exposed to these things. But yeah, there's a lot of addiction in kitchens, but a lot of perfectionism. I mean, there's a lot of real interesting stories in kitchens. But I knew that I loved cooking, but I didn't love it like this, you know. And I believe God gave me a month of insomnia during that summer. And I felt a deep calling to shift and pivot away from culinary arts into psychology. And I went before the church and just really, I mean, I just really laid that before everyone.
This is when you were still in high school? Oh
yeah. Yeah. It was because it was going from my junior year into my senior year, you know? And so then this really hard shift now, I mean, I had all my schools laid out that I was going for culinary. So, I mean, it was huge. It was a huge shift. And so I ended up going to Northwestern College in St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, I still had a major in psychology with an emphasis in criminal justice. And so I was still working up there in that area, because I thought, I'm just going to be a psychologist. Like, up in Minneapolis, it's about 90% of their corrections are probation. So they try to do a lot of preventative work. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do that. And I loved it again. I actually became a probation officer during grad school. Pre-trial probation officer. Amazing stories with that. Working with female theft offenders. Fascinating group of women. And still, I felt honored to be on multiple sides of people's stories, but I kept being pushed towards the preventative side, you know, before corrections, you know. And so, you know, my faith has always informed the way that I relate to people, the advocacy, right? And wanting to sit in as many stories so that there is that bridge of compassion and empathy. So, you know, I kind of dropped the criminal justice side and moved more into the just more of the clinical, like the community clinical side. But my faith and my walk with that was always a part of even in grad school. I developed a program called Sacred Spaces, which was really just, thank you, God, for that, where I incorporated, it was like a 3-hour program. I asked the pastors of the church I was attending at the time if I could put this on in the church, and they were absolutely fine with it. It was in inner city St. Paul. And in Sacred Spaces, I would design these beautiful hand-designed invitations, and we'd give them to these women, women of color, inner city women. And they were invited to this event where for like the first hour, we would do some type of spa experience. We would learn how to sit in silence and just allow to be still and know that God is here. And then we'd make like sugar scrubs, things that were really accessible that they could get. And then upstairs, we would have this area totally converted and with roses and everything. And I would make a gourmet dinner for them. Amazing. And it was healthy. That was one of mm-hmm. my things. I wanted to be healthy. They're like, I can't believe, you know, are you going to make those tofu chocolate chip cookies? I mean, these chocolate chip cookies without tofu, they loved them, you know. But everything was super, super detailed. So they would walk away feeling, you know, really taken care of. And they're like, I don't even know what it's like to be silent. My neighborhood is so loud and stuff. So it was so exhausting to do that, but I felt so inspired during that time because it was like God bringing back a passion of mine, which was cooking, and bringing in psychology in a way that, you know, there was just a unity. These things are not mutually mm-hmm. exclusive. None of these things are, you right. know, women were healed through food. They were healed through silence. They were healed through just community. And
golly.
It was awesome. And
I want to go to that.
Yes. Well, you know, now they're more a little bit like pop-ups. I did one back when I was at Strong Tower, when Strong Tower was out at the People's Church, when it was the People's Church. Mm-hmm. And we did one of those events. And it's just, I've done them at kind of little pop-ups at different churches yeah. over the years. You know, and I've found ways to continue to keep that cooking piece in there because I believe that food heals on yeah. so many levels. And just the conversation over food is so healing. So, you know, and I'm putting this on this podcast, and my husband and I are going to have to get on the same page about it. But what I'd love to start doing is something that I've inspired by a friend in Louisville to offer Sabbath feasts at mm-hmm. my house. And doing some just quarterly Sabbath feast.
I'm so in.
Yes, yes. And that's what I want to do. And we have plenty of backyard yeah. for it. You know, and now that we are coming through the other side of COVID, I yeah. believe we can do this safely. And so, you know, and that's everything that I do as a psychologist, as a believer, is all wrapped into this sense of community, story, being nourished and being connected. And having that just kind of welcome table, yeah. Because that's what my parents really taught me. Their table mm-hmm. was always welcome, you know, and I can go home at any time and I'll have just some random person, just totally random person come up and say, your father changed my life.
Wow.
And, you know, and then I immediately know, oh yeah, they have done time, mm-hmm. you know, but you know, it's great to sit and hear their stories, you know, of things that have happened since that time. So
amazing. Yeah. Well, tell us about your work that you're doing now with the Village yeah. of Kairos and,
Well, so yeah. what can we say? It's definitely been a practice that has evolved over time. Mm-hmm. I think the best way to think about the Village of Kairos is that we are a practice that comes alongside every member of a family system or even mm-hmm. an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And we want everybody to have their own person. So we have multiple practitioners that will work on a single system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the ways I like to think about it is that we come alongside your story with our own stories to tell. Like, you know, that we're worthy to hold those stories with you. Mm. And so we try to match people who have similar experiences, you know. So one of my staff in his mid-40s and has a real passion working with men, and he's really found his kind of strength in working with fathers who feel really, you know, thrown under the bus in some ways and not seen and not heard, you know. And we make sure that we have our mothers sit with my clinicians who are mothers, right? And to sit in that. So we try to have, we build a village truly around the family.
Exactly what it sounds. That's amazing.
Exactly. That's exactly what we do.
Well, one of the things that I feel like I've noticed a lot about 2020/21, because it's kind of all seems to be coming together for people. It's not like nothing ended at 2020 that we wanted to end. So, but one of the things I've noticed, and I feel like a lot of us have noticed, is that the year really revealed a lot to people about themselves, about their communities, about people around them. And so I was sitting around a fire with a bunch of women recently, and we were sort of, we were talking about all the people moving to the Nashville area because they're trying to get away from all these other, you know, areas of the country that, and they feel like, you know, they're coming to Nashville because life is so much better in Nashville. And not, I, life is great in Nashville. I moved here myself 6 years ago because I was wanting a different pace of life. So I understand that. But what one of our mutual friends, Katie Hasseltine, said, she started laughing and she said, yeah, that's why every single therapist in town has a waiting list 3 months long because we're all just so perfect here. And so, and it's true. I mean, I know that every therapist I know has a waiting list, and they're very, very busy because so much has been revealed. So much of our stuff has been shown to us. And thankfully, a lot of people are going and getting help and wanting to do the work. So in your practice, in your work, in your, cause we haven't even talked about, you're also consulting and speaking and stuff. What are you seeing, what are you seeing a lot of, and what are some things, this, particularly maybe with, well, I wouldn't even say just with the faith community, but what are you, what are you seeing a lot of, and what's really taking up a lot of your mental space as an always learning, forward thinking psychologist and person of the kingdom?
Yes. Well, I do want to say we are accepting patients now. So we do not have a 3 month, we do not have a 3 month waiting list at all. So definitely there, but what I'm seeing is, I'm going to say profound anxiety from young people to our adults. And also symptoms that I would say are, you know, almost a traumatized response to almost a complicated bereavement. And what I mean by the complicated bereavement, it's like when we're living in just survival mode, we don't have time to process everything that has been lost, right? We're just trying to stay in our safe place until we give ourselves that permission to exhale. And so what I'm finding right now is that we're getting clients that are exhaling, and it's like this weight. Like there's no going back, right? There's a redefinition, of course, of normal, right? But the things that once were are no more.
Yeah.
And it's like people are now giving themselves a permission of, look how much we've lost. I've lost time, you know, and let's just be real. COVID is a very interesting, when we have viruses or any type of natural disaster, there are things that become clear or clarify. And so we're also seeing, you know, and I'm not just saying myself, but my colleagues and I, we're seeing a lot of brokenness in marriages. And what that's showing is that perhaps work was our escape from problems.
Right.
And when work comes home, all of those things start to become very, very apparent. Some people thrived, Like, actually, my husband and I, because I travel a lot, I was traveling a lot before, I think our marriage got stronger. It's like, wow, what's it like to be with each other, you know, all the time like that. But that's not true for everyone, right? You start to, we became aware of what our addictions were. And, you know, and some of those addictions could not be satisfied in comparison to others. So I think a lot of people now are, to use this metaphor, a little bit more clean and sober. And the truth is there now that cannot be denied. And so we're getting a lot of people now coming to this sense of, wow, I'm a mess, or there's a lot of brokenness that we've not addressed and now I need help.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that happens in any type of crisis when we finally get that breathing space. It's not necessarily like it's over. It's like, oh, let's look at everything now. And we've got kids who are also observing that, right? They're observing those pieces. I don't want to say across the board, but there's maybe a little bit of protection for kids who are so used to social media being their way of connecting, right? Like that didn't have to stop. But at the same time, when it's your only place of connection, you know, what I'm finding is more anxiety provoking for kids is what's going to happen when we're more social.
Right.
Right. You know, the internet can be, you can curate yourself as you want to be.
Yeah.
But when you're in flesh and blood again, then the differences and the lacks and all those things come up for kids. And so what we're anticipating, we have a lot of people out of the office right now, a lot of our clients out of the office because people are traveling, but we all take it as a calm before the storm, because come mid-July when school is about to start about a month out, that's when we see an uptick of anxiety, and we want parents to be prepared for that. You know, it's hard to make so many changes, and there have been very, very huge destabilizing changes for the globe.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're seeing, is people processing a lot of that depression that has sometimes overwhelmed or doubled down in the isolation, right? The very things that people were working desperately to get through, they had to just live in. So yeah, this is kind of the wake up now, you know, to all that has been.
I that resonates so much. I've talked to several young people who are experiencing a peak in anxiety just from re-entering into the world. And it's not just younger people, it's adults too.
That's right.
Like, how do I show up in the world after everything we've just been through, after everything I've seen that I can't unsee, and you know, having faced the things that we had to face when all of our vices were removed.
Yeah,
that's really good. Well, we talked a little bit about, like, there's a difference between being offering Christian counseling and being a counselor that is that is Christian. So can you talk about that a little bit, and what how you navigate how you navigate your work?
Yeah. So mind, body, soul, and spirit. I mean, we are very holistic in our approach. So we don't believe that faith and psychology, which is the study of the mind, which also then relates to the health of the brain, are mutually exclusive, right? We create these separations for study, but they're really false connections. I mean, we know that we work in this kind of unified way, right? And we operate in this unified way. And so when a person comes in, we are definitely going to entertain what the client wants to focus on, right? And so if a person were to come in and say, you know, I am a Christian and I would really love my faith to be entertained, I have an intern who identifies also, a couple of people who identify as Christians. Absolutely. We welcome that in, right? If there are people who come in and say, you know, I'd really like my faith as a Buddhist or whatever to be entertained, then we will try to collaborate with another community practitioner who can bring that in, right? Like if that is foundational, then we're not going to be necessarily a good fit. Now, here are some things that we think could actually help you in your journey, but we will not be a good fit if that's the foundation, if we don't have anybody who holds that, right? Mm-hmm. Because we don't have to be all things for all people, right? There's a whole body of therapists in the city that we do collaborate with, right? But at the same time, I have had, we've had, you know, families, we've had, you know, gay couples come in and they'll ask, Dr. Webb, we know that you're a Christian. Is that going to be a problem for you to work with our children? And I will say, A, I'm really sorry that you feel like you have to ask that question because that is not a question that even as a believer in Christ, I would ever ask a medical doctor if I had need, you know, I mean, these are not questions that I would ever, ever ask. And I said, you know, why are you here? Well, my child is suffering. That is our touchstone. Right. And so we find those common touchstones and our goal is to end suffering. And we bring in as many people as possible to aid in that. So if we need to bring in a pastor to understand what's going on, if we need to do that, we will, right? But Christian counseling is truly its own discipline. And so I don't think we need to be Christian counselors to, you know, partner with Christian counselors. And I do have conversations with Christian counselors like, yeah, I know that this is something diagnostic. This is not my wheelhouse. And they refer, right? Recognizing that the lines that are kind of blurring their work and vice versa, you know, in the same way that sometimes people will get referrals because clients have so much trauma, they can't even sit in just standard talk therapy. And so that's it, that's what we do. And then when they stabilize and they can come back to those other goals, then we continue to broaden their village. So, you know, but we also will say if Christian counseling is what you want, there's some beautiful, beautiful places here that can provide that for you. And that's, we're happy to give you those referrals.
That's good. You talked earlier when you were talking about your parents, you talked about them modeling sort of a hospitality in your dad's work in the prison, but also welcoming people into your home and around your table and people saying that their lives were changed, you know, by your father and things like that. So how do you hold space for that in your work? How do you incorporate that sort of hospitality into your work?
Wow. You know, there are, you know, in terms of whether I can have clients at my home, I can't have that.
Right. That's true. Yeah.
but at the same time, you know, I have an office in Franklin and Nashville, but Franklin's a small town. And so there are places where I do, we intersect, right? And so, you know, I certainly welcome those intersections and we just discuss, right? But where I see hospitality showing up is at the moment people come in, typically the feedback we get even into the office is, oh, this feels like a spa, you know, and you know, before COVID, we always made sure we had food, like that people could have. We'll return to food, but it'll just be a little bit, a little bit different. You know, we always, I loved having our parents come in and sit at the table and just nourish themselves. One of the locations we had was across the street over the Skerritt Bennett campus in Vanderbilt. And there was a labyrinth there. I miss that labyrinth because sometimes we would have parents, you know, I would just say, you know what, today I can see the distress, go walk the labyrinth, right? And now it's like, you know, sometimes I'll see that in parents and be like, go to Starbucks, we got your child, you know? So we try to help whoever's coming in to feel that welcome, to feel calm. We typically don't use a lot of our fluorescent lights because we already know that that overstimulates cortisol stress. We keep certain rooms that are not lit, where parents can rest while their child is in therapy. And I have big bean bags. We also have a little therapy dog who's with me here. He's not a service animal. he's more of an emotional support animal at best, but they love him, you know? And so we do try to create this sense of welcome. My long-term goal is to move out of all of these offices and find a house where we can set up therapy because, you know, that's why we're accepting patients, because we got to get to that house, you know, but it's so important to me for people to feel that sense of home. And plus, that's my long-term goal with getting into a house where I could actually cook as well. You know, that's a big dream. Have a community garden in the backyard. Because that there's so much healing in that, you know, but we try little ways to create that sense of hospitality and welcome to the village when they walk through the door.
That's so good. So we're one of the other things that's come up a lot, especially in this area in the last year, has been some of the legislation against, or I should say for LGBTQ inclusion and schools and that sort of thing. What are you seeing there, Dr. Webb, in terms of your work, and how do you navigate that also from your point of view?
Yeah. So, you know, we certainly have a fair share of, you know, clients in the LGBTQ community. And what I'm seeing is just a lack of understanding from their kind of community, and sometimes within their family, sadly, of the level of suffering, the level of dysphoria that they're experiencing. And I think that's an important piece. Like, we could talk about the prevalence of social media and the influence, but I don't see it any different than sometimes we have parents who would come in and say, I think my child is self-harming because they're seeing it on social media. Well, they are seeing it on social media. And where is the suffering that makes the transfer from watching something to doing something this profound to the body? And I feel the same way, especially even within our trans community, is we don't minimize, we certainly honor and respect what's going on, but also we sit in the suffering, and it is profound. It is profound, you know, in terms of getting to what they desire, which is often just that sense of safety and security, and consistency, right? Consistency within themselves and consistency in the world around them. And so one of my colleagues that I deeply respect talks about this as gender spaciousness and having just curiosity and openness to looking at whatever those different, you know, parts of identity are, as well as rooting out any trauma that has occurred, right? Be that from bullying to also just trauma that has occurred, period, right? Because what we want is people to be autonomous, feeling that autonomy in their being, to do what they are going to do in their lives. And there's a lot of education that we have to do, but we definitely want there to be a safe place for everyone to land, even within families where people are having different views about this.
Right.
We want every member to feel held and understood, because what we say is there is no threat in acknowledging where your loved one is, even if you don't agree. So you can acknowledge where a person is and not agree and engage in loving behaviors. Right.
Again, you don't have to forsake one for the other.
No, no, absolutely not. And we want that for everybody, right? Even if it's, you know, as much as we may want our loved ones to acknowledge who and where we are, you know, to force that is no different than them forcing you to acknowledge something that you don't believe that you are, right? So it's acknowledgement and, you know, and loving behaviors, even in the presence of non-agreement or disagreement, right? So, and we'll find our way through. We'll synthesize that. That's a lot of what we work on, is how do we find this, you know, peaceful space. And we're deep advocates, of course, for our LGBTQ, especially youth, because the incidence of homelessness when they get put out of their homes, I inhale and exhale on this because there's to me nothing so impossible to manage that we put a minor on the streets. There are no good ends for kids on the streets. This is an area that's very strong for sex trafficking. And children on the streets have very few options. So we definitely work against any of the kind of aged out foster kids who are put on streets or kids in the LGBTQ who are rendered homeless. And so we really want to create safe harbors and to have conversations before it gets to that point.
You do, you mentioned foster kids. You do a lot of work with families who become foster parents and adopted parents, correct?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, can you talk a bit about that as well?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we typically don't get a lot of the young adopted children. We get more of teens. And I think the greater challenge with that is a lot of water has gone under the bridge, you know, and gone over the bridge by adolescents. We also work with many parents who've actually adopted children in their adolescence. And so these are kids who've been in the system for a greater amount of time. And that has its challenges, significant challenges. And that, again, that just started happening organically, where we were getting a lot of kiddos coming in from adoption to the point where we would have groups that were 100% with kids who were adopted, parents who've adopted. And that was actually really powerful to create these common tables, right?
Yes.
Where parents could really feel validated, like, oh, wow, you're dealing with that. I thought I was the only one. No. Right. And so that was super, super important to us to create those tables of safety. And then, you know, we've had a season where we had a lot of children coming from transracial adoptions. Those kids being able to sit at a table with each other and talk about what it's like to be in a home like that was very powerful for them to create those bridges of understanding. So we create tables as we get kind of different kind of mixes coming into into the office that kind of creates those good conversations. So yes, we do definitely work with adoption, foster care. My love and my desire would be to bring in families that are contemplating, you know, adoption, and to be able to help them address some hard questions ahead of time. Like, do you actually desire, in a shame-free zone,
yeah,
do you actually desire to adopt a child of color? Because you do not have to, right? And if you are, then here are the questions I have for you in terms of preparation. Like, so I would really love to move towards equipping as well, so that we don't necessarily get to that point, you know, where we're 17 and we're burnt out and we don't know what to do.
Right.
You know? So, and, you know, we've had a lot of families that were not told that adoption is inherently a trauma. It's a beautiful thing to adopt, of course. It's a beautiful calling and mission. And the separation of a child from a biological parent has a trauma to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so we've got to talk about those traumas. We've got to talk about the impact of that. Yeah.
I feel like there's so many things that we've talked about today that so like true. We could do like a 6-part series on like, you know, go deeper on each of these things. But we talked today a little bit about gender, about race, about trauma, about sexuality. But one of the things that we talked about before we hit the record button that I thought the things you had to say around it were so important about identity. Can you share with everybody a little bit about that, about what matters when it comes to identity and all the work that we do and as we work to become whole? Can you talk a little bit about that?
So certainly in the context as believers, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And I'll just speak from my own experience. You know, if I were to kind of play with all the spokes of identity, and there are many different ways to think about identity, but some of the big heavy hitters, right? Socioeconomics, gender, sexuality, sex, which are sexuality and sex are two separate.
Yeah.
You know, nationality, ethnicity. I could say that I am an African-American female, right?
Right.
you know, grew up upper middle class, all of these things. Okay. When I enter into the temple, okay. And when I decided to become a Christian, and accept that calling from God, none of those things were higher than that calling. It's not that they didn't matter, but they were not higher. And that my whole kind of growth as a believer is about surrendering those identities, right? You know, and I want people to think about that surrendering isn't like being handcuffed, right? I think that's what people think. Like you get surrendered, you're like handcuffed, like in a police situation. It's more of opening your hand, right? That these are these things that are in your hand that maybe we grasp on so tightly to, and we think that this is so much us, that the action of surrender is opening your hand.
That's such an important distinction between the handcuff and the open hand.
That's right. And, you know, and actually when you can open your hand to all that's there, then, you know, God's loving action, whatever he's going to do with that is going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. We're all in need of healing on some area of those spokes, right? And, you know, it's like, you know, when you're a child and you've been wounded, you don't, you're so scared of how your parents going to help you. Like, I remember when I got my first splinter, I was terrified and I'm like holding my hand. My dad's like, just open your hand. Let me see it. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's really what it is that all of these identities, we think that they're going to be taken away from us in some way and it's going to be bad, but it's more of open your hand so the Father can see it. Right.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that it'll be taken away, but it does mean that it will be transformed.
Yes.
Right? So nothing can be higher than that. Nothing can be higher.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I imagine that at the end of some days, you just want to go home and just, I mean, take a bath, do whatever can to just unwind from the heaviness that you probably experience throughout the day walking with people. But in closing, I'd love for you to share with us what do you see and experience that brings you hope?
Oh, gosh, what brings me hope? You know, in my work or just in general?
Anything and any, you can answer it any way you'd like.
Yeah. What brings me hope is that no matter how bad it gets, there's always another dawn. Right?
Yeah.
And even in the lowest moments with the hardest stories, I can always hear the laughter of my children. Like the children that I work with, you know, that there is hope always. I peddle in hope. I don't know any psychologist who can't. We see the problems, but we are always looking for the diamond, even if it's lost in the ruins of our clients' lives. So that's the hope, is that no matter how big the trash heap, there's a diamond there.
You know, it's there.
It's there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how can people find you?
Yes. So you can go to our website, the www, the Village of Kairos. Kairos is spelled K-A-I-R-O-S. You can follow us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page where every Friday we do a free teaching and training by me. We sometimes do interviews. And so follow us on Facebook for sure. We also have an Instagram account, but all of our contact information is on the website. And we are accepting patients. So there's no 3-month wait.
That's great. And so, we'll for sure put in the show notes, we'll put your contact information and and we will gladly give your information out to anyone who calls us and reaches out to us at Journey.
Oh, we are so glad. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you for your time, Dr. Webb.
If you enjoyed today's episode, we would love it if you would share a screenshot of this episode to your Instagram story and tag us at journey_TN. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app.